No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
Was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So call in and be part of the conversation at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype your questions to BBSRADIOPR. Tonight we have a special guest, a return guest, Admiral Joe Sestak, a former member of Congress, an admiral, a Harvard graduate. I could go on and on and on about this man, but if I did, we wouldn't have any time to talk to him because he's got a resume that's just unbelievable. So first, let me welcome Maria.
Hi.
Hi, Maria. How are you?
We're actually mourning the death of Kobe Bryant
here in
Southern California.
What a terrible thing that he...
The crash occurred like 5 miles from my house. And
oh, my God.
Yeah.
And that he should lose his 13-year-old daughter
as well.
And you know, I've never been a Lakers fan, but certainly a basketball fan. And he was absolutely amazing. And our condolences go out to his family. I'm not sure if his dad's still alive. His dad used to play for Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just an amazing basketball
player.
But
a wife
player.
And two other daughters. Actually, three other daughters. They just had a baby last year. Well, another girl.
Isn't that horrible?
And he owned a facility that's another 5 miles from me the other way, and the speculation is that he was going there. It's a state-of-the-art sports training facility that the public can go to, as well as, you know, highly elite athletes. So I can't tell you the outpouring that have come into me. I've been a basketball fan my whole life and a Lakers fan since I was raised in Southern California. So it feels surreal, and it almost feels like a member of our family is gone. I mean, that's how much we loved him.
Well, he was an amazing player, and the Lakers are an amazing basketball team, and he was just, you know, one in a million. And he will be sorely missed, and it's horrible. He was 41 years old.
Yes,
taken way, way too soon, and. Mm-hmm. Well, our condolences go out to his family, but let me introduce again our special guest tonight, Admiral Joe Sestak, who was a candidate for President of the United States until recently, and we're happy to have him back on the show. He was on once before and was an amazing guest. So welcome, Admiral. Thanks for coming back on. We really appreciate it.
Senator, thank you. Maria, thank you. And let me just add to both of your comments. Our loss as a nation to a person that truly was distinguished as an individual, as a man, as well as one of the greatest basketball players, but also his daughter, having faced my own daughter's challenges several times with brain cancer, there couldn't have been a worse double loss than that. And everyone joins with both of you of your fine words upon our loss for this nation.
Yeah, and that's all right. As parents, and Maria's a parent, it's all our worst nightmare, right?
Mm-hmm.
To fear the loss of a child, and his wife to have to go through this is just a really terrible thing. one of the reasons we wanted to have you back, Admiral, is not only that you were a great guest. You know, some guests are good, but you were really, really good. But also, you know, if I had to leave one piece of advice to my children, it would be, you know, what Albert Einstein said, that what you see depends on where you stand. And, you know, everything's relative. And now that you're not in the race anymore, that's where I want to start the conversation. What do you think about what's going on? I'm about to go to the Iowa caucuses, at the end of the week. I hope you'll be there, and maybe I'll run into you. But what do you think about the field right now?
Well, I've always thought highly of the field. I mean, across the board. I am a bit concerned still. I think what you just spoke about Einstein's statement really said it all for me. It isn't just, you know, where you stand is what we need to do today. You need to stand in the other side's shoes.
Yeah.
And to some degree, I have felt strongly, particularly in Iowa, even more so than in, let's say, New Hampshire, that as I tried to stand in others' shoes, that is, those in the rural counties, those who were both Democrats and Republicans who voted for Mr. Trump, I'm not sure yet that we have had that individual who has clearly broke that is saying, yes, I want to serve this nation as president, but I want to be able to do so by being able to govern. Because, again, I think this primary has, and it started coming back a bit, I think, has been so focused upon who might win that Democratic primary that I fear that perhaps some of the way that the races have been run is they may not be able to not just win against Mr. Trump, but to be able to garner the hard support, not hard in full support, but hard in begrudging support that we need to heal this nation. Our next president's greatest mission is that, or we will have another president who can only do executive orders. And that's my still standing concern with the state of the race.
Well, mine too, Admiral. I must say that as a Democrat who's been in politics for 4 years, sometimes I don't think the Democrats get it. I don't think they're getting it. I don't think they understand that person that you're talking about in rural America. I think, you know, this idea that our mission is to resist as opposed to govern is very problematic. And I agree with you 100%. Maria? What do you think?
Last time that we spoke with you, Admiral, you were staying, was it at the Econo Lodge in Iowa?
Yes. Very much so.
And they were
3 months.
Remodeling. Yeah. And it sounded harrowing and uncomfortable and arduous, and yet you persisted and stuck true to it. Would you do that again with retrospect?
Yes, I would. I absolutely would. The only thing I might change is, rather than, and this is a tactical, not a strategic change, of instead of 90 straight days there, I think I would have flipped to a few of the other leading states even sooner. Because by the time I got there, I had lost 3 more months just for that name recognition. For example, I walked the 100-plus miles across New Hampshire by foot when I got there. It took me about 8 days. I went to to visit vets who were incarcerated in a maximum security prison. It's one of the most progressive prisons we have in America. I went to a mental health facilities, and I also went to those who were teaching trade schools. Each day I do several events as I walked. And I think that name recognition and getting to know that state, I might have, as well as Iowa, I would have done earlier. That said, to the point that I wanted to emphasize, for example, even in New Hampshire, we have an economy today that people in New Hampshire say is 2.4% unemployment. In Iowa, they say it's about 2.5%. And yet, if you look at those who are unemployed, particularly in the rurals, where the Trump and Clinton supporters are from the last election, is their unemployment rate in both states is about 8.5%. If you include those who have lost their jobs and don't have the skills to get another job, they're the artisans, those who work with their hand in the mines, so that when now you have wireless tractors in Iowa, eight people lost their jobs on perhaps a farm. Who's there to train them? How about the guy or gal loses their job in a coal mine? Who's there to train them? We pay less than any developed nation in the entire world on training for a lifetime. 0.001% of gross domestic product. I only bring this up because as we talk about the Democrats forgiving college loans, again, what about me for those guys and gals who are out there, lost their jobs during the recessions and still can't get them back? Because we don't have what we have in the military when I served, which you lost your job because you were fixing the F-15 and now that's going out of business and the JSF is coming. We send you to the Community College of the Air Force for 3 or 4 or 5 months, our dime, and we've trained you for the new one. That's what we don't have for those who I think we need to say, yeah, we may be Democrats, but we get what you need.
Well, that's an absolutely brilliant point, I think. And by the way, my brother was the vice president of Community College of the Air Force. So, he just retired as a matter of fact as president of a community college. When he retired as an F-111 pilot and then went into college administration because of his experience with Community College of the Air Force.
But
you know, that's absolutely true. And what is it? I mean, we don't even have parking lot attendants anymore. You come out of you come out of the place and you stick your card into a machine, and you know we're getting rid of all these kinds of jobs, and we're not replacing them with any. And that's so important to have that kind of education. And you know, I went to a high school in Montgomery County, very wealthy county in Maryland, but we had all sorts of programs. We had all sorts of vocational programs that don't exist anymore in high school. And we
like
had an auto shop, we used to make fun of the girls that were the beautician program because they had to wear uniforms in school. But then when we got out of high school and we were all working in gas stations and McDonald's, they were making a lot of money working at Elizabeth Arden. So, the joke was on us. But, you know, I don't know why we're not embracing things like that as Democrats. And let me tell you, I think it's a sad thing that you're not in the race anymore, because I think you're an important voice. And I think that as we narrow the field, that voice gets muffled. And
there's,
yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
If I might, Senator Maria, one other example. And I say this because when I was a congressman and ran for Senate in Pennsylvania, I watched as Democrats who ran statewide went to 6 of the 67 counties, because you could win governor or state or senator by just winning Philadelphia County,
yeah,
Pittsburgh County. And so you forgot the rules. And then, so we're talking about Medicare for All, which will rely upon, under Bernie Sanders' plan, and understandably a fine goal, of having for-profit hospitals like Johns Hopkins in Maryland or University of Pennsylvania Hospital stay, but they'd be paid directly by government. But yet, when you go to Iowa, they are going to lose 20% of the rural counties in the next 5 to 7 years, according to Kaiser Health News, and the same 18% in New Hampshire. Because when you're in Iowa, you can see that 2/3 of the counties have lost population in the last 5 years, and only 2 have grown, and the rest are stagnant because people are leaving the rurals. Who's going to stay in the rurals when your rural hospitals have closed? 5 had closed in New Hampshire in the last few years, for example. And yet we tend not to say, wait a minute, how are we going to get the rural hospitals to say that are not for profit? So, for example, I believe we should have a model like the Veterans Administration Hospital. People critique it rightly at times, but the New England Journal of Medicine has said that the VA, the Veterans Administration Hospital, has actually provided equal to or better health care at less expense than they have in any private or public health care provider in the nation, when you look at it overall. Why not take that as a model for the rural counties? Because otherwise, if you're not training them there for the next job, coal mining, going to green energy technology potentially, and you're not providing health care, what employer is ever going to go to the rural counties and say, hey, I've got a hospital here, because there's no hospital, you're not going to track employees. And that's what I'm trying to say, that I'm hoping as this election goes on, we understand that not all, but many of those that we want to be able to help govern and say, well, he or she ran a great campaign and they kind of get my issues, I'm going to still not be for them all the way, but I'm not going to fight them. And that's what we have to do, I think, if we really want to get this nation to begrudgingly fight some, but nevertheless come together in some unity to start passing some keen legislation to move this country forward.
Well, and that's really the crux of the issue right now. This just that we can't get anything accomplished. And, you know, I'm a child of the we're probably not very far apart in age, but I grew up in the 1960s, and the country was very, very divided on the issue of the Vietnam War. But I don't ever remember anything like this. I don't ever remember a time where there was so little cooperation, where the objective seemed to be to make sure the other side didn't win, you know. But we've said this many times on this show, as Dr. King said, an eye for an eye leaves everybody blind. You know, yeah. We're not getting anywhere.
Yeah.
And I agree with you 100%. How about you, Maria, my Republican friend?
Well, I would like to give our listeners some context here, because Admiral Sestak was a 3-star admiral.
Yes, he was.
And in the U.S. Navy. And then was elected to the House of Representatives, and then ran for Senate, and then ran for president, and retired the campaign last month. So what, Admiral, can you give us from your unique perspective of having gone through those iterations? Was it different? Was it the same? Was it politics makes everybody a liar? What is your perspective, having this global view of the world and then having this national view of our world?
Well, great question. Perhaps my answer, which might be in two quick steps, is somewhat formed that when I ran the very first time, I ran purely because my daughter had brain cancer when I was in the Navy. I retired, and when she survived it, and it was glioblastoma, which John McCain, Ted Kennedy had, and only 8% of children survive, less than 1% of adults survive. So my payback tour to the country for the healthcare plan we have in the military was to run on, I'm a retired Navy admiral, running on national security begins at home in health security. And I did it in a nearly 2-to-1 Republican district. Becoming the second Democrat since the Civil War as a congressman, I, Maria, was very conscious that I had to make sure I was addressing the issues and the concerns while staying with my principles of the Republicans I served. So what I found there, that you could actually do principle compromise without compromising your principles. I voted and fought and had 10 town halls for the Affordable Care Act. And, you know, I'd get there half an hour early. I'd shake the Tea Party's hands because it was my second term of congressman. And then as a senator, they continued, as I was running for Senate, the Tea Party had begun. I'd get there half an hour early, shake all their hands. They'd yell, they'd scream, and I'd stay to the last one left. And by the 10th town hall, the Delaware County Tea Party Patriots, which was in my district, asked for a photograph with me. Now, they didn't vote for me. but it mitigated their anger and their angst. So it gets to number one. I was formed by that. So as I went to the Senate, I went to all 67 counties twice at least. And then when I ran, I went to the rural counties in Iowa and New Hampshire. I did the walk across it. And what I learned and applied more and more and I found was similar, although much more grander in scale, of course. And you can't do it as well and as deep. But it was, remember that fine saying in To Kill a Mockingbird, where it was said, you can't know a man until you stand in his shoes and walk around with him. It got to where you began, Senator Einstein, saying that you have to reverse it and say, you got to walk in their shoes. And so, Maria, what I found, and again, it gets to this, maybe I'm getting to be one-tone Joe Sestak, that you better, and that's why I walked across that state in New Hampshire, citing that saying is, we have forgotten, and I felt it, as I ran for Senate, and I was called by the senator who was in charge of the making sure the money flowed into the DSCC and wanted to become the next majority leader, just stop walking across Pennsylvania. Get back and fundraise. I said, I've got enough money right now. But if I want them to know that I want to know them and listen to them. Well, you know, when I didn't do it, of course, my party, as you may well know, put over $8 million in against me. And so my point was that we have to be better at understanding it's not a win, I win, you lose. It's how can we have a win? And you get a bit of a win, too. But it's the principles we're driving towards. And so, yeah, there's differences of gradation as you grow. But that basic thing has to be there. And I don't think we've got to. And I think, you know, that's why Truman did his train drive going around. And, you know, as he was doing his whistle stop. And so my take is somehow we've got to gain that back, that we listen and then are willing to be accountable for what we say. And when it fails, we admit it and say it's my fault. I didn't achieve what I told you I would.
Well, you know, again, Admiral, part of this may be your military training, because I've never met a bunch of people that are more stand up than veterans. I mean, you know, if there's anybody that takes responsibility for what they do, it's certainly the veterans that I've met in my life. And we also know when you campaign, and you know this, the most powerful thing you can say is, I'm like you, right? You know, I'm sure that you always mention that, well, you probably don't have to mention that you're a veteran, because veterans relate to that. I was a Teamster. I always say that when I'm in front of a Democratic crowd, that I understand what it's like to be a member of a union, because I've been a member of a union. It's a very important thing to say, and I think that it's a real problem that we have in the Democratic Party, that we talk down to people. We talk down to these people that you're talking about, that you met while you walked across Pennsylvania, you know? And I don't know what we do about that. That's a real terrible problem. But I have a question for you. I was honored to ride the first motorcycle in Rolling Thunder this year, which, if our listeners don't know what that is, it's hundreds of thousands of mostly veterans that come and ride to the wall, the Vietnam Memorial in Washington, D.C., to pay tribute to veterans. And they let me speak. And the thing that really got me is that veterans were, the crowd was absolutely wild for Donald Trump. And I guess I have a hard time with that. I don't understand why veterans love him so much when, you know, we see him denigrate the colonel who has a Purple Heart. I've never even heard of a politician, being talking down to somebody that has a wounded soldier. And now we recently, of course, with this recent attack, the VFW is on his back, about, you know, his comments about trivializing brain injuries. Why do you think veterans love this man so much? Do you have any insight into that?
It is a question that I've been asked several times. And I don't think my answer is perfect at all. But I think when you step back and look at how the Republicans are sticking with the president, despite items like you said, that part of it is in the military is when you look at a swath, and I've done it when I was in the military, and it hasn't changed. In fact, it's probably getting a little bit harsher, is where our recruiting comes from. Where are those who volunteer to join? It starts about Pennsylvania, sweeps through the South, a bit into the West, and some a little up in the North in the Midwest, and then kind of gets to California and stops. Yes, you find them all. But in my last job as a three-star, I was responsible for the Navy's warfare requirements, and I had to follow this personnel issue. And so where they come from, if you're growing up in Washington, D.C., you tend to grow up as a Democrat. You grow right. up in rural Arkansas, you tend to kind of come from that. And so I think part of it is that, and part of it is what we discussed a bit. It is that this lack of trust of the other side has grown so enormous. Because in the military, to the point, Maria, you kind of raised for me to answer, and I talked about walking in other shoes, but Senator, you added something to it. I ran on a slogan called Accountability for America. And accountability is a hard word, I think, to truly understand. But in the military, when the captain of a ship was given more authority and honor than any other person on that, and responsibility, knows that with that authority and responsibility also goes accountability. And if that ship comes to harm, or the crew comes to harm, he or she, the captain of the ship, knows that they will be relieved for cause. Even if they're asleep at 2 a.m. in the morning and that ship comes to harm, they're relieved because they're responsible for training that crew that no harm will come while they grab a couple hours of sleep. And if that captain we know in the military is then not relieved for cause, then that crew begins not to trust. Because who wants to trust a leader who feels themselves beyond accountability? And therefore, the crew will begin to disintegrate from a well-disciplined, ordered crew into chaos. To some degree, that's what's happening to the U.S. ship of state. And when you don't trust, and you have echo chambers on both sides, who's not walking and talking and listening and talking, but the other side is wrong, and this is what it is, you just have a natural tendency to side with your side and not trust what the other side's saying. That's why getting down there and not having to agree with them. But boy, I'll tell you, my first day as president, when they used to ask me what I do, I'd say that first day I'd hold a town hall in middle America. And I wouldn't leave for about 8 hours. To everybody in that stadium who really wanted to try to get a question would. I'd fly to Paris to convene the world for climate change, one of the two greatest dangers to America and the world. And on the way home, I'd announce that Training for a Lifetime program. But when I land, I'd walk into a gun show. And I'd ask Ollie North, who used to be president of the NRA, who ran my backside when I had to decide whether I was going to be Marine Corps down in Quantico in the early 70s or not. And man, at that time, I'll tell you, what a leader he was. If you didn't have to have your hair cut so short, I would have gone Marine. But anyway, I'd say Ollie walked with me. And I just want those who have, as per the Heller decision made in Washington, D.C., you can agree or disagree with, but it said you have a right to a gun, but there are limits to that. And I'd walk in and I'd say, you have a right to a gun. But Ollie and I got in over the years when I'd go on Fox News and I used to go on Sean Hannity about 5-6 times, I'd stop and see him or he'd call up. And we disagree on this issue, but we need gun We need to close down the loophole with these gun shows. And here's why. And we need to do this. Doesn't mean they're going to agree with me. We need to have assault weapons ban because police officers alone had their desk plowed to zero from assault weapons when we had one in the 90s. But I'd go there and do those things. Then I'd walk into a mosque and say, I went to war with those of the Muslim faith. And they had my fixed. And I'm here to tell you, mighty. That's what I'm trying to get to is we critique rightly the incendiary words at times that this president uses. Well, then that next president has to be as comfortable walking into that NRA and say the words, but in a way that listens to and says, I respect your right to a gun, but there are limits. And here's where we stand because we must. And it doesn't mean you're going to win them, but you mitigate that you're not there listening and talking and willing to be accountable so that they'll trust you even when they disagree.
Well, and you know, that's I'm about to go to the Iowa caucuses, and maybe that's what we should do. Every American should have to go to the Iowa caucuses because it's really a great exercise in democracy, right? All these people get together in a room. There's no rancor. They don't yell at each other. They discuss the candidates, and they come up with a choice. And you know, in the end, the thing that really blew me away in 2016 is that if there's a tie, they cut a deck of cards. That would never happen in Washington, D.C. If there was a tie, the next thing you know, there'd be 100 lawyers in the room fighting over who actually won. You know, but... Yeah, I agree with you, and I don't know how we get to that point. How do we get to that point? Because it seems that both sides have the same attitude that they just want to resist. Yeah. And so I don't want to speak for Maria, but Maria and I started this show with the idea that with a Republican and a Democrat, we could come to consensus on a lot of issues, and I think Maria would agree with this, that we agree on more than we disagree.
Correct.
But how do we bring the country around to that point, to trust again?
But may I say, Michael, to your point about the veterans, is that I think that Donald Trump has courted them, including not doing the wreath laying ceremony at Arlington in November of last year, instead attending the Veterans Day parade in New York City on their 100th anniversary. And I think he makes people feel who haven't been heard or feel like they haven't been heard, and then the first sitting president to attend the March for Life rally. Agree with that or not, he's doing things overtly to court, I think, marginalized constituents that feel like they are being heard, which is why they said that the Rust Belt or the flyover zone in the Midwest, suddenly they felt like somebody was listening to them.
Right. I think you're right about that. And whereas the Democrats will pay lip service to the military and stand up there and tell you that our military is the greatest fighting force in the world, which I believe it is, they don't reach out in the same way. I agree with that.
And he didn't even march in the parade. He just showed up and spoke. So it wasn't like he was looking for limelight. I'm not defending the man. You know that, right? But I'm just saying, I think that's the reason that the military is feeling some love for him, is that they feel like they are being recognized for their sacrifices. I don't know if you felt that, Admiral, from him at all.
I think you said something that's very extraordinarily important. I when I lost the Senate race, I went to teach. I did some other things, but I think good teachers learn. So I went to teach at Cheney University, the old historical black university, because this is in my district, and the African American community did my best demographic in support in that race, and I wanted to pay them back. And then I taught at Carnegie Mellon, taught at others. I taught a course on ethical leadership. And it was based on a great book by James McGregor Burns written in 1978. And it talks about how you have to rise people to other and higher expectations and how you have to be willing to be accountable to people over even party. And at the time, Christie was governor of New Jersey. And if you remember, during that race with Mr. Romney running and Mr. Obama running against each other, you had a hurricane that swept ashore. And the President Obama, visited New Jersey. And Christie put his arm basically around him and said, hey, I don't care about this race right now, Mr. Romney and everybody. This man is here to help my people. Now, you can agree or disagree if that was serious or not. But the point was, as I told my class, the issue here is he demonstrated that issue of accountability to people, and he also talked to them, answering their call, where they would have at times might have felt marginalized, as I think they might have down south during Katrina. And, you know, people showed up and was almost reluctant, and FEMA wasn't doing their job right and all that. And he did what you said, Maria, there. But I also said the challenge then to get to also how you said you, that, you know, may not be your guy, is that's where a false prophet can step in by answering that I know you feel neglected. People are crossing the border and taking your jobs, and that's wrong. Where in reality, instead of addressing, he says, I know what your problem is, that, you know, it's not that someone's taking a job. We don't have training for a lifetime for you, but we don't do that adequately. And Mr. Trump stepped right into that hole and filled it. And I think you're spot on in what you said, Maria.
Well, and I agree with that, too. I think that, you know, I heard somebody from the Washington Post recently on CNN, an editor for the Washington Post, say that he thinks that people don't really go out and look for the facts, but they actually look for things that support the feeling they already have about things.
It's called confirmation bias. It's a psychological term.
Yeah, and you know, it's absolutely true. I think that, you know, I say that I've seen that in my own family. You know, I come from a family of immigrants, and, you know, they believed, that some of them believed every stereotype you can imagine. And they would always reconfirm, you know, they would see somebody, they wouldn't notice Dr. King on TV, but they would notice an African American cashing a welfare check in a liquor store. You know, that's the thing that stuck in their mind. Not anything good that was being done. But and I think you're right. I think that they've stepped in there. But I have to tell you that when I went to, right after the election, I went to a meeting, and this woman stood up and said, as Democrats, we have nothing to apologize for. And all I could think of to myself is, of course we have something to apologize for. This, we've laid the groundwork for this to happen. You know, if we had been doing our jobs, if we had been, you know, more sensitive, if we had reached out to people more, we wouldn't be in this situation. But I think this is our, I agree with you, Admiral, this is our great challenge. What do we, you know,
it really is.
And what about the Chinese? We see, as the world is changing, you know, I go into these international conferences, and everybody wants to talk about China. Do you see, are we creating a void that the Chinese are filling? Because we're, I don't know if you want to say asleep at the wheel or whatever, economically. Are they the great looming danger for us?
The answer is yes.
Ooh.
I mentioned earlier there was two great challenges, climate change, well, the second, and it's equally so, actually more, is the rise of an authoritarian Chinese world order. Let me give just a couple quick examples. I backpacked, first of all, through China back when the very first year that independent travels by Americans, early 1980s. They had just opened up cities, and I would go into Wuhan, the city today that has this outbreak of disease, epidemic disease. They'd never seen a Caucasian. I was there, and 100 people would follow me because they'd never seen one before. I wish that had happened in my campaign. But anyway.
You were running a good campaign. You were just in the wrong country.
And you could see they were a great people. You could just see them. But their leadership on the president's eye has undertaken under the Belt and Road Initiative to where there are today over 70 countries that have signed up to the Belt and Road Initiatives, which is basically predatory loans that these countries can't pay. So, for example, Djibouti, 85% of its government funding comes from a loan from China. And when it couldn't pay it back, it said, that's all right, but I want my first overseas naval base to be in Djibouti. And that's where it is, in Africa. Same thing happened to Cambodia 3 months ago. Sri Lanka had to give them its port for 99 years. Greece gave up its sovereignty by saying, okay, I'll take your loan. And because of that, Greece had said, I will block the unanimity needed by the European Union to condemn, which it needed unanimity of all the European Union nations for it to have condemned China's incarceration of the Muslim Uyghur citizens. We have to understand this is a different authoritarian world order of where its values are might makes right. It's why the Prime Minister of Malaysia has said China is the new colonial power. Well, these are vassal states, not because they have the army in there right now, but because they have predatory loans by which they tie them by them. Number two, take the 5G network, which is probably the greatest threat of all. If you build it, the 5G network, you own it. And every one of those countries, when they sign up for the Belt and Road Initiative, hangs up for the Digital Road Initiative, where you must take the 5G network. We don't even make the part. After we sold Lucent overseas, that is for the 5G network, because when you put that piece of gear in that only three companies in the world make, everything that comes through that network, you don't have to hack. You see it. So if you're doing a business meeting, the Chinese will see it, just like you turn it on your television. If you have artificial intelligence coming through there, now that might be encrypted, they will then have access to it to sit on their own and break it as they record it. And by the way, when you go back the other way, there's no barriers that you can do any damage you want to critical infrastructure, such as shutting down the electricity if they use, we use Huawei 5G network in Los Angeles. Third, if you have an Android phone today, because 90% of all mobile phones and computers are now made in China, the supply parts, everything you say or hear goes right back to China. We have the servers that have come, boards that have come for servers in Amazon, in the Navy Aegis ships, CIA drones, and also Amazon, servers for Amazon and Apple that are now had servers purchased from over there that have microchips in them that can listen in if you've read Bloomberg News over about a year ago. And so we have outsourced not just jobs by our corporations, but they outsourced our national security to China and then lobby our government on China's behalf to keep this going. We don't even have people understand this is all going down because although our commander of the entire Pacific military said a year and a half ago, America now no longer commands the Western Pacific. China does. Validated by the Australian leading defense tanks that we, the first loss of command of the seas by the United States Navy since World War II. And this isn't really just military. This is economic. This is diplomatic. This is values. We are seeing our world order as our president is kicking allies and leaving them behind and telling them it's a wrap. This isn't America and China. This is a liberal world order based upon values of individual human rights, open and fair government that we established under presidents and maintained from John F. Kennedy to Ronald Reagan. And we are walking away with the only way to ensure that we say, China, this is not your day to think that your values are going to overtake ours. And that's the real challenge America has to have. It's somebody in that White House who understands foreign policy is domestic policy, and we can only preserve our American dream by banding this world together under our vows, even in trade.
Well, and how do you feel? You mentioned that the first crisis is climate change. Does this, because I see this as having great potential to bring us together around the world, because it's a problem that nobody can solve by themselves, right? We have to come together. No single country can solve this problem. So we need to, at some point, for our own existence, come together and to work on this problem together. Do you think there's potential there for us to do that?
Yes, that's why I mentioned to you earlier the five or seven things I would do the first day after the town hall in America. I'd fly to Paris to convene the world in climate change. That's what we do best. After, since World War II, having fought the second of two world wars in 26 years, that world's greatest generation of World War II came home and said, we're not going to go back a third time. And they built this liberal world order that won the third world war, the Cold War, without a shot. And they built the World Bank, the IMF, the United Nations. We didn't do them after World War I to make sure when you had another recession in China, in Europe, that could have gone to a great depression, the IMF and the World Bank and us was there to mitigate that. And so, yes, can we do it? But remember now, China is doing climate change. It's the worst polluter in the world. Now, we're the worst just about per capita, okay? But they are now going to export 1,800 of their coal plants because they want to clean up their country, but they're going to be exporting them to these other countries, and that's what they're doing today. We have such a challenge in climate change because right now, when you go into the tropics, only about 4% of the people have air conditioning. 50% will have it by 2050. And if they get just the typical air conditioner, because, you know, when you move into middle class in Africa, if five of the top nations in the world developing are in Africa today, and as they move into world class, they have to get an iPhone or a smartphone, you get air conditioning. And right. So if you get the one from Sears, it will be equivalent to deforesting two-thirds of the Amazon. This is a potential to bring it together, but the economic and the dynamic, you're going to have to have a leader that can talk and understands China, and how do you get them to incentivize not to sell those 1,800 coal plants that they're forcing upon these people because their laborers from China then go and do the work. So this is going to be, people haven't even begun, this isn't about the Green New Deal. We could do that and in a decade, and it won't make a difference because 80% of the greenhouse emissions come from abroad. And so, yeah, it's got a potential to do that, Senator, but the challenge of a leader who gets it and can somehow understand the incentives to bring other people together is going to be the daunting challenge because every one of those countries wants to be in middle class, and that means a lot of consumerism and a lot of more greenhouse emissions. You better make sure that green energy is what they use, not the coal mines.
Well, that's absolutely you know, that's absolutely true, Admiral. I once, when I was 18 years old, back in before Maria was born, I went and I stayed on an Indian reservation in, I was traveling around the country, my sister worked with Indians, and I stayed on an Indian reservation where they had come and they had, the government had made all these really nice pueblos, air-conditioned, really nice, you know, they had designed them. And a bunch of kids, college kids, we were all hippies back in those days, came and told the Indians how horrible it was that they wanted to be middle class because they really knew where it was at. Well, the Indians, let me just say the local sheriff came in just in time to save the college students from being beat to death by people who just wanted to, you know, they wanted the same thing everybody else had. So I think that's a normal condition, and you're right. I just came back from India, and we're seeing there's just incredible development going on over there. I don't know how we address that challenge.
Can I add, if you both don't mind, one issue about Indian reservations and Native American Americans? I mean, it shows you, man, walking in other people's shoes. And one other thing, back to Maria's question about, you know, changes and differences, but yet similarities of how to handle it is only because I went out to Iowa, did I really learn about Iowa Native Americans and a bit. And you talk about understanding with how they look at things, or they being the you know, just unnamed all, but here now in the America, I did not know that 5,000 Native American women disappear or are murdered every year, and we don't know why. Imagine.
How is
if
that,
that
possible?
Was a Caucasian woman out. Don't know. They don't know. These are founded studies that people talk about, because I started doing research, because I spoke at a couple, and I was blown back by it. And they made sure that I knew that when I was there. Part of it is this. It is how our law, and Maria, great question, because there is a slight answer to this. Now, this is just on reservations, this is throughout America, but they don't know why. But part of it is that 82% of all sex crimes on a reservation are by a non-Native American man who walks on the reservation, does his crime, and walks off. But now you have where the Indians Native Americans have sovereignty over their laws. They arrive on the reservation. Right. When he's left, then you've got this challenge of trying to work through the complexity of another nation. America trying to deal. When United States Navy ship, we pull into a port, and I know this, and one of my sailors is arrested, let's say, and I had that over there or there in the Middle East. Before we go, we have status of forces agreement between sovereign nations that said, look, if our sailor is arrested, we're going to visit or not visit, depending upon if, you know, I know you have this type of law, but we have the right to a lawyer and you don't, and this is what's got to be done if it's going to be done. And you come up with a status quo agreement. Remember, that was one of the issues with President Obama had to face, right, where the Iraqis didn't want to give us one for any U.S. troops that remained there. And so these are sovereign nations. We should have an agreement with them that, in my opinion, I stated this campaign trail, and this is upsetting many people, that, you know, if someone commits a crime there, there should be a status quo agreement that, you know, we'll return that person.
Right.
To be held for that crime.
Yeah.
And so that's part of it. And people know this out there, and that's why they get away. And again, walking in other people's shoes. But to your point, making sure that it isn't, you know, we can see challenges, you know, in certain disenfranchised, marginalized communities. But we also got to remember that we need to get back to, you know, that, let's say it's that 55-year-old construction worker, middle of Pennsylvania, who was laid off, white, and you know, no college education, and all of a sudden he's lost his job. And 5 years later, we come out of the recession, and where's the skill that's taken over by kids, and now there's new technology? Where's training for a lifetime? And if I could leave with one last point, because I was promising my daughter, this was so great, but I also promised my daughter I'd watch the first episode of Networks for Mrs.
Oh,
Maisel tonight.
Oh, you got to do that.
so
yeah. Anyway, democracy begins at home.
Yes. She's poking her head in here.
Yes, she.
All right.
David Brooks. With David, the women.
Yes, without a question. I grew up with six sisters. And
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. No wonder you're so smart.
Blessed art thou amongst women.
But David Brooks wrote an interesting book once. And in it, and to leave with this point, that because you mentioned Senator Facts. And he I've forgotten the name of the book, but it basically takes two embryos, they grow up until their deaths, and kind of at the end of each chapter, they experience themselves through life. He stops and has some analysis based upon studies and facts that show the point. And one of them that struck me was, it was a University of Pennsylvania study, as I remember, that he cited, that those who are presented with the facts that differ from their own view, and they have high school education or less, are more likely to change their opinion than those with college, master's, or PhD. Huh. There's always this image that you know, someone out there in the Midwest might not, and here it is. But no, the study shows that those who have gone on for education are so often feel so righteous in their opinion that they may be less likely. They are less likely, according to the study, to change it when presented with facts. So this is a very important point you brought up. People say, well, facts don't matter. Well, you know, those 10 town halls, it's hard in today's, you know, because of disinformation and Twitter and all, but those 10 town halls proved in retrospect to me that it takes a politician's, a public servant's time. And those were, that took a lot of time to sit there and work it through. And so when people disagreed with me as a congressman, you wrote a letter in that said, I don't agree with your position on choice. Or you know, you get some pretty tough, nasty letters.
Yeah, you do.
Well, what we did is we went back to them every quarter, every 3 months, and said, you had to care. You had to have skin in the game. 8 o'clock Saturday morning, congressman's happy to meet with you all. We had 60 people show up, stayed there for 3 hours, listening and talking. Yep, we didn't. And then we did it a month, 3 months later, and about 40 showed up, and 30. And isn't that we agreed? It's that at least they got a chance to have their say, and to me to listen, and to discuss back why I just had a different voice. And I think that's what, to begin with, our conversation began this evening. That's what we have to show more than Billy do, because Maria, you pointed out, Trump did that, or appeared to do that. And then, more than anything else, be accountable. Because you, Senator, I think, said Democrats somehow, I think it was lost accountability or something like that.
Right.
Yeah, where's those Democrats who said, I voted for that war in Iraq?
Yep.
And you know, ISIS today came about because of that war. Where's the accountability for 2 decades of America's involvement in an expanding, metastasized ISIS conflict that was because people didn't understand, know the world, and whoever said I was accountable? And I think that's why we've lost trust as one.
Well, and that's a great way to end the show. And I'm going to let you go because I don't want a letter from your daughter. I don't want to get a bad letter from your daughter. But thank you for being on the show again. We so much appreciate your insight. We think that it's really important. Please go enjoy your Netflix, and I hope that in the near future I get to see you in person. I'd really like to say thank you and shake your hand, sir.
And throwing your hat into the ring, too.
Have a wonderful, wonderful evening.
Okay, you too.
And to you, yes.
And tonight we're going to leave you with a song. I usually pick a song that honors our guests somehow, but today I'm taking a point of personal privilege. This song goes out to a dear friend of mine who died this morning of a heart attack. His name was David Fay. He was a bartender and a cook. He never had 2 nickels to rub together, but he was a constant reminder to me that it doesn't matter who you are, what level you've reached in life, whether you're rich, whether you're powerful, what's really important is what's underneath it all. And underneath it all, David Fay was a prince. So this goes out to you, David. We will miss you. And Maria, we'll see you next week.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.